Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Vice President Mike Pence abruptly canceled a recent trip to New Hampshire, and this week we learned why. Former Republican House Speaker Bill O'Brien jumps into the U.S. Senate race, hoping to unseat Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen in 2020, and Governor Chris Sununu sets a modern record for the number of gubernatorial vetoes in a single year. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we're going to talk about them in this hour. If you've got questions about the week's news, send them by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Dan Tuohy, NHPR digital engagement producer, and Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, newly appointed New Hampshire State House reporter for the Union Leader. Congrats, Kevin.
Thanks very much, Peter.
And thank you, everybody, for being here.
Hey, Peter. Good morning.
So lots to talk about this week. Let's dive right into it, starting with Vice President Mike Pence's canceled trip to New Hampshire. We learned the reason, article in Politico this week, because he was likely going to encounter someone who was accused of distributing fentanyl. Jeff Hatch, an employee at Granite Recovery, where Mike Pence was going to appear, is cooperating with federal authorities now. Maybe start with you on this, Kevin. So what did authorities say Hatch did?
Well, essentially, Jeffrey Hatch was, until this story broke, kind of a recovery success story. I mean, he's a former NFL Giants player who drug abuse and alcohol abuse forced him out of the NFL. He became a changed man, became a crusader for people in recovery and worked for the Granite Recovery Center. But it turns out, according to federal documents that were released Friday with his guilty plea, that back in 2017 he was responsible for helping to arrange the delivery of 1,500 grams of fentanyl from Lawrence, Massachusetts to New Hampshire. And that was in July of 2017. So this has been going on now for 2 years. And he's been not just involved, he was potentially going to be involved with Vice President Pence. He's appeared with Senator Jeanne Shaheen at a couple of her events. He was at a roundtable with U.S. Senate Republican candidate Don Baldick earlier this month.
And so the cancellation would be so that Mike Pence hadn't had a photo op with this guy.
Exactly. And I do think what this kind of also reveals the sort of seat of your pants advance work that this administration does, because we've seen it in other places as well.
I mean, they should have known about this sooner and not scheduled this trip?
Right. Or this guy should have been flagged and caught before the night before this visit. And you shouldn't have had the vice president sitting on a tarmac in Air Force Two and to be told by the president you're not going on that trip. But they do things kind of on the fly very much, this White House, President Trump does, and that's why it was only at the 11th hour that Pence was pulled back.
Dean, what do you think?
Yeah, the optics of this whole episode were really fascinating. You know, it broke on Twitter that Vice President Pence was on his way to New Hampshire, but had been recalled to Washington. So there was immediate speculation. You know, what's going on with President Trump? Why would you recall the vice president to come back? you know, literally turn around Air Force Two. And I believe this was the same day that there was some sort of an episode at peace,
yes,
or hypothetical episode about shots fired. So
that turned out to be nothing, by the way.
It turned out to be nothing. That is correct. But that added to the kind of the mystery of the whole thing. And they said, well, you know, I think Trump said you'll understand in about 2 weeks. So they left it very vague. I mean, this individual was a high profile, you know, success story. Anytime you have a former NFL player, that's an opportunity to publicize the whole recovery process. And I think there's going to be a plea deal where he's agreed to serve something like 4 years in prison.
Dan Tuohy.
Yeah, and there remains speculation about what happened or what didn't happen. And I don't believe we've had a statement from the White House or from Vice President Pence's office yet on the follow-up. And just to add that, you know, the CEO of the Granite Recovery Centers put out a statement saying this gentleman was terminated immediately when they found out.
Mm-hmm. So they didn't even know. Yeah. Right. Nobody really knew.
No, and it also appears that he only got 4 years because of the amount of cooperation that he provided to federal authorities. That's one of the reactions we had to this news this week. Governor Sununu and Senator Sheehan both issued statements saying, we look forward to this evidence that he provided enough cooperation to get what Sununu called a lenient sentence, which would be about 4 years. We don't know how much he cooperated. We do know that federal authorities in New Hampshire and Massachusetts have cracked down on fentanyl trafficking from Lawrence to New Hampshire, that dozens of people have entered much more serious guilty pleas than this one. And so the question becomes, is this what Jeffrey Hatch has been doing the last couple of years, acting surreptitiously almost as a mole inside this fentanyl trafficking ring to lead to this catching this much bigger fish?
And fentanyl has proven to be particularly lethal in the whole opioid crisis, very deadly in New Hampshire.
So likely that Vice President Pence might reschedule his trip?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. That's what his office says. And, you know, we all know the opioid scourge remains a big issue here in New Hampshire, and it will be for 2020 with the presidential race and here in the state.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. In just a few minutes, we're going to be speaking about the issue of likability when it comes to running for president. But first, I want to talk about something pertaining to the U.S. Senate race, because this week we learned former New Hampshire House Speaker Bill O'Brien announced he's going to run. There was some speculation about this. We've talked about it on this program. But he made it official this week. Kevin, what did he say in his announcement?
He basically said... He talked about, I'm not from Washington. I'm going down there to fix Washington. Senator Sheehan is from Washington. She is the swamp, as he referred to it. He vowed to be a foot soldier for the Trump revolution, to continue to campaign to help this president. It's important to note Bill O'Brien was a Ted Cruz supporter in the 2016 campaign, and at times had some not so flattering things to say about candidate Donald Trump, but that's obviously water under the bridge. And he's, as I said, said he will work very hard to be in the Trump team.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive when you realize this. Bill O'Brien is a former House Speaker who worked closely with a former state rep by the name of Steve Stepanak, yep, who's the chairman of the state GOP. This is how small New Hampshire politics can be on a world stage. So, he, you know, obviously, Stepanak is a co-chairman in 2016 for Donald Trump. Obviously, I believe in the state primary as chairman, he will be neutral, of course. But there's a lot of connections here. People know Bill O'Brien and the base of the party. We'll see how he does in what's going to be a very strong GOP primary.
Dean.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we often think about New Hampshire's politics as a somewhat, at least at the state level, a somewhat separate political ecosystem from the national political environment. But Bill O'Brien really was one of the first politicians back when, after the Tea Party Revolution in 2010, when he became Speaker in 2011. I remember a lot of his agenda and his discourse and political narrative really connected to what was going at the national level. And we've already seen that again this time, where he's talking about helping President Trump build build the wall. He's calling Gene Shaheen a socialist, which is something that I think Republicans are going to be using nationwide and certainly at the presidential level. And so there's again, he is really kind of plugged into this sort of conservative slash now Trump party networks nationally. You know, he may be competitive in what I think is going to be a really competitive Republican primary. But, you know, in a general election race, Gene Shaheen is going to be difficult to unseat, especially with Chris Sununu no longer having an advantage. You know, she typically does well with independents and moderates. O'Brien, not so much. She's got millions of dollars in the bank already. So she's going to be a formidable opponent. But I'm looking forward to what's going to be a really interesting Republican primary.
Kevin?
Yeah, he was a movement conservative, right, when he was the Speaker of the House. I mean, he helped engineer the business tax cuts that are in place now and are such a topic of discussion with regard to the vetoed state budget. He had a lot to do with reducing regulation. A lot of people will remember the repeated attempts he tried to pass the so-called right-to-work bill, very anti-union Republican candidate.
And also tapped into the national debate over voter identification, et cetera, with voter ID rules.
He did, and earlier this week, even before he got into the race, put out a list of endorsements that was pretty impressive. Folks like former Executive Counselor Dave Wheeler, State Senator John Regan, dozens and dozens of past and present members of the House, people in the vineyards, if you will, who feel Bill O'Brien is their mentor, is their leader. But as my counterparts have pointed out, Don Baldock is in this race. Brian Corky Mesner, trial lawyer, very wealthy trial lawyer who now lives in Wolfboro, he's going to get into this race. It's going to be very expensive. And I think that's one of the keys here is, can Bill O'Brien raise the money to be a statewide candidate?
Yeah, it's amazing when you look at this race, because we see it often, almost every 2 years in New Hampshire, we have these very powerful or well-known men and women who have no voting record. Bill O'Brien has a voting record. If you see some of the press releases coming out from Ray Buckley, yeah, the chairman of the New Hampshire Democrats, you almost get the sense that they would love to see O'Brien win the nomination because they know who he is. You know, General Baldock, of course, served honorably in the military, you know, other success stories coming forward when they announce. When you have a voting record, it makes, for an opposition party, makes it just a little bit more easy to quantify and try to identify them as if they're trying to do already.
Well, let's take a moment and turn to issues pertaining to the presidential race in the 2020 campaign. And joining us for this part of the program is Ella Nilsson. She covers Congress and the Democrats for Vox, and she's a former Concord Monitor reporter. Ella, thank you very much for joining us on the program. Really appreciate it.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And we're having you on because we wanted to talk to you a bit about likability, which you're writing about for Vox. You looked at a CNN UNH poll that tried to take a look at likability, especially as it pertains to gender politics. California Senator Kamala Harris got a bump after her performance in the first Democratic debate. Elizabeth Warren also had high favorability. So what did you see from this poll?
Yeah, well, so I was going through the poll numbers, and I think the thing that struck me the most was, as you said, Warren and Harris both had high favorability, which is sort of more of a generic question that pollsters ask about kind of how you think Canada is performing. So Warren had 67% of likely New Hampshire voters say they had a favorable opinion of her, and 54% said the same percent, 54%, excuse me, said the same about Harris. But then pollsters asked a separate question, which is, which Democratic candidate do you think is most likable? And the thing that really jumped out at me was that the numbers for both of these women just dropped dramatically. Just 4% of likely voters polled said they found Warren likable, and 5% said the same thing about Harris. And the thing that was so striking to me was that all of the male candidates that are running, that are in the top tier at least, had much higher likability ratings than the women.
Mm-hmm. So likability, it seems, applies differently to male and female candidates. What do you think are the ramifications of that?
Well, I talked to a number of political experts and pollsters that have been kind of studying this question for years. And I think the thing that we should just say out front here is that it's really hard to quantify what likability is in sort of a precise way, because likability itself is such a subjective term. I mean, when you think about it, like, who do you like? What do you like? It's, we all kind of bring our own completely unique personalities and opinions to that. So when you ask people, like, what do you like? It's really hard to kind of pin an exact science down on it, because it just kind of comes down to people's opinion. But it is something, I think, that the reason that it's so important, especially in the context of 2020, is that research has been done that shows that likability is much more important for women candidates than it is for male candidates. Voters, both men and women, put a higher premium on liking women candidates in order to vote for them. So, you know, they might vote for a man if they don't like him, but they think that he's well qualified and has the experience, but they're much less likely to do so for a woman candidate.
Mm-hmm. So how important is it that we even talk about likability, given that, you know, in theory, maybe in a perfect world, we would be voting for candidates not based on, you know, how much we'd want to hang out with this person, but based on their policy decisions? How important is this in the long run?
Yeah, well, I think it's really interesting. And obviously, I think the word that has been coming up a lot, even more than likability in 2020, is electability, because there is just kind of this obsession with what Democrat can beat Donald Trump in the general election. And that is playing out in, you know, the primary, when Democrats are still trying to figure out who they want their nominee to be. They're just like, can't stop thinking about the general election. And I think that it's important that we don't, it's a really tough thing to do. I feel like likability and electability kind of get wrapped up into the same box sometimes, but they are two different things. And so I think that when we talk about this question, we need to be aware that likability itself is a really hard thing to pin down. But it's something that's not going to go away from the conversation. It's something that pollsters have been asking for a while, and it's something that women candidates have had to face. But I think that we sort of need to go into this conversation at least with an awareness of, when we're talking about likability, what exactly does that mean? It's kind of hard to know.
Well, Ella, we have to leave it there with you, but we thank you very much for reporting on this. We really appreciate you joining us today as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Ella Nilsson covers Congress and the Democrats for Vox. She's a former reporter for the Concord Monitor. And you can find a link to her reporting and all the stories that we've discussed on the program so far today at nhpr.org. Remember, if you have questions or comments about the week's news, you can send them by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Still to come on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, we're going to be talking about campaign money raised so far for some of the Democratic candidates. The union leader's been reporting on who has raised the most money in the most recent quarter and who has the highest number of donors. We're going to be talking about that. We're also going to be talking about a brand new veto tracker, gubernatorial veto tracker, at nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
On Monday on The Exchange, it's the first in a four-part series airing every Monday through August 19th on K-12 education in New Hampshire, with subjects chosen by listeners. So tune in for The Exchange live at 9 on Monday morning for that. But right now, we're taking a fresh look at the events of the past week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. In the studio with me, Kevin Landrigan, the newly appointed New Hampshire State House reporter at the New Hampshire Union Leader, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and Dan Tuohy, NHPR digital engagement producer. Before the break, we talked a little bit about likability as it pertains to 2020 presidential candidates. And before we move on from that, I wanted to hear a little bit from Dean Spiliotis.
Thanks. Yeah, it was a very, Ella wrote a very interesting article. I encourage people to check it out. And, you know, she raised an issue that has been something that political scientists have grappled with years. You know, political scientists talk about electability, favorability, likability, viability. They're all kind of the same, but kind of different, and they all get at various aspects of candidate appeal. combined with the likelihood that somebody might win the general election. And quantifying them has been a real challenge. I think we tend to fall back on favorability versus unfavorability ratios. That's something that's been polled for a long time. You'll hear political professionals talk about fave-unfave ratios. But this is a challenge, trying to get at how people very subjectively think about leadership and candidate appeal and who resonates with them on a variety of different personal dimensions. So she raises an important issue. It has aspects of it that deal with gender, which is something that's getting a lot of research attention now, how people respond to candidates by gender, particularly at the presidential level. Yeah, just to mention that probably the most famous example of this goes back to the 2008 New Hampshire primary. In the last debate before the primary, I believe it was at St. Anselm College, and Scott Spradling, who was the WMUR political director at the time, asked Hillary Clinton why more people didn't like her, and she kind of tried to lightheartedly laugh it off and said, oh, that hurts my feelings. And right in the middle of all that, people may remember Barack Obama kind of interjected, oh, you're likable enough, Hillary. And he got a lot of criticism for that. It was not one of his stronger moments. You know, he went on to lose the primary for a variety of reasons, but that even over 10 years ago, we were grappling with this issue of gender and likability and leadership.
Well, I was just going to say, it was great to hear from Ella. We once a Granite State gal, always a Granite State gal, and we miss her, but it's we're still following her great work down there with Vox. But this campaign is going to tell us whether the paradigm is changing. And I think we saw a potential for that just recently. Peter, you referred to it in talking with Ella in the last debate. When a candidate like Kamala Harris starts out a question saying, Mr. Vice President, I don't believe you're a racist. Now, in past campaigns, covered a few of these, a lot of voters would look at that candidate who is a female and say, well, that was pretty catty. And instead, Harris soared in the polls as a result, and it was a defining moment for her. And when Cory Booker tells me he doesn't believe in this lifetime there's going to be another Democratic presidential ticket with two white men on it, that tells me things are changing. And there's a lot of talented women in this race. But Ella seized on something. There isn't any question about it. Elizabeth Warren's campaign is laser focused on this because their own internal polling is telling them people agree with you on the issues, but you have to loosen
but,
up.
But
you've got to be more likable.
Ironically enough, if you look at 2016, you had two general election candidates in Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton who had some of the highest unfavorability ratings we've ever seen in major party nominees. And so, you know, it really kind of depends on what the range of choices are. And this is kind of the flip side of likability. In the end, maybe you're making choices based on other criteria.
Well, at this point, there's another way that voters can indicate their approval or disapproval of voters, or at least a measure of their approval, and that's campaign money. And Kevin, the union leader, reported this week that South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg raised the most money of any candidate of either major party in the last quarter. And it wasn't even close, right? More than $20,000 more in the last quarter.
Correct.
How well is he doing on the money front exactly?
He's doing really well on the money front. And he's raising it in big dollar chunks. I mean, meaning he's getting a lot of big donors, big name donors in New Hampshire. That would be folks like Gary Hershberg, the co-founder of Stonyfield Yogurt, Ken Burns, the very familiar filmmaker and from Walpole. He's raising tons of money, and like I said, in very large amounts. And that was the striking part of this. He raised so much more money than all the other candidates, almost $70,000 from New Hampshire. And that's a lot from New Hampshire. You need to remember people don't have to give here. So, and most people don't give here. And you don't go to New Hampshire to raise money. So why is this important? Well, because the polls, we're fascinated by them. They don't mean anything right now. The activists, to Dean's point earlier, they're so overwhelmed by two dozen candidates, they can't decide which five people they like, much less which person they like. So we're not that first primary, as we call it. Booker stood out as the first person to get 50 activists endorsing them. So what do we have to gauge support? This is one way we have to gauge support. And particularly we gauge it from the small donors.
Yeah, that's an important point, too, because Bernie Sanders didn't raise as much money as Pete Buttigieg, but he had far more individual donors.
When we say far more, he had 1,200 individual donors.
Where Pete Buttigieg had more than 300.
Exactly. No other candidate had a third that many. He had 1,000 people in the state giving $100 or less. That's significant. And here's why. Because when people give those small donations, those are your real true believers. Those are the people that pack President Trump's rallies. This is why you still have to worry about Bernie Sanders if you're in this race with him, because he has a lot of these very devoted followers.
Dean.
And this issue of number of donors is something that Elizabeth Warren has used repeatedly to go after Joe Biden as kind of doing the traditional, big fundraiser type of approach to raising money. And so just by way of putting some numbers to this, we're talking about New Hampshire. Joe Biden raised $41,000in the same period that Bernie raised $46,000. Joe Biden had 131 donors. Bernie had 1,239. So it's a very different approach. And it's something Elizabeth Warren, who also raised $41,000 on a little over 300 donors, so three times the number of Biden, this has become an issue. And it's increasingly in the Democratic Party seen as almost a badge of honor if you have a lot of small donors rather than using big bundlers.
Yeah, it's the great divide. Politico did an interesting kind of macro piece about campaign finance. And they looked at the bundlers. These are the people who raised at least $100,000 for Hillary Clinton in 2016 or $50,000 for Barack Obama in 2012. Who are they giving to? And the answer is they're split. Kamala Harris is getting them, Joe Biden is getting them, and Pete Buttigieg is getting them. And both Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are celebrating by saying, we're not taking their money. Back to Dean's point, they're trying to turn a negative into a positive, and try to cast them as the candidates of the establishment and the elite, and we're the candidates of the working people.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. I want to tune to NHPR's Dan Tuohy for this next one because Dan, you've been tracking the number of gubernatorial vetoes this year. Republican Governor Chris Sununu has issued what's being called a modern record of number of vetoes. So, Dan Tuohy, is this terribly surprising, given that, we've got a Republican governor and a Democratic legislature?
To the extent in the number of vetoes, and he's not done yet, as we know, there's a lot of bills still out there in the wings that have yet to land on his desk. In his first term, he didn't veto all that many because the Republicans had majority control of the legislature. That changed this year, of course. Democrats now control the House and the Senate. And we're talking with news director Dan Barrick earlier this week and the managing editor and my colleague Casey McDermott about, all right, let's try to get our arms around this because there's so many of them. What are they, of course? So we assembled a spreadsheet and we offered it up on our website as a veto tracker, which is pretty unusual, but almost like a candidate tracker. But we have 38 vetoes now. We all know a couple of the big ones, like the state budget, SB1, which is the Family Medical Leave Act. And the governor has said pretty clearly for months that he would veto SB1 and some of these other bills. He alleges that SB1 is a backdoor income tax or a front-door income tax for Sununu's perspective. But you look at the number of bills, and I know Democrats have said some of these bills are not along party lines. Some of them have bipartisan support, bipartisan sponsors, right, Kevin?
Yes.
So it's amazing to that degree and look at the modern record. And the governor says he's not out to set a record, but it is a record. So, the tracker here really, we will update this as we go, including the bills that are vetoes that have been overridden. To this date, there's only been one, and it's the state capital murder statute, which is the death penalty abolishment, which the legislature did override. And it's just looking at, the number of bills here and really— Governors in New Hampshire do not veto all that many bills. They talk about it all the time. Mm. It's a political question there, right? I think a lot of these bills that a governor, she or he, will let the legislature know that this is not going to pass muster and it never makes it to his or her desk.
Well, worth talking about one of those things that he vetoed, the state budget, because that's still an ongoing discussion at the legislature. Kevin Landrigan, yes. You've been covering this in detail for the union leader. So I think the biggest fight this week was in part about money for the developmentally disabled and services for those people?
Yeah, it was, but there were almost 10 state agencies that came to the Legislative Fiscal Committee. The developmentally disabled issue is an important one. We've spent a lot of time on this program talking about it. These are folks who are adults with developmental disabilities who are put on a waiting list for services because there's not enough money to treat them. And the legislature, in a bipartisan way, over the years, has worked hard to eliminate that waiting list. Enter the vetoed state budget. Now, we're now operating under a continuing resolution, which means agencies are only given for the next 3 months a 3/12 budget, and it's only a budget of the average 3 months over that year. The last state budget ended on June 30th, and at that point, there was $15 million in an account for the wait list. But because the budget was vetoed, that money lapsed, so-called, went to the state treasury and increased the surplus, and the agency couldn't get at it during this continuing resolution. So that's why Health and Human Services Commissioner Jeffrey Myers had to go to the Legislative Fiscal Committee to try and get permission. Now, why did this turn into almost a six-hour meeting on Thursday? The reason is, politics, because you had a democratically controlled Legislative Fiscal Committee in a conundrum over trying to make it easier for state government to function during a vetoed state budget. In other words, we're letting Sununu off the hook if we answer all these demands for spending. We're relieving the pain that comes with a vetoed state budget, and we don't want to do that. So in most cases, they provided some money. The parks would have had to close. And why was that? Parks spend half of their money during the summer tourism season. So if you give them a 3/12 budget, they're going to be out of it by the beginning of August. So they got their money. But in many cases, the fiscal committee decided to give just enough more money for the next couple of months, which would force these agencies to come back in September for additional money if the continuing resolution continues, but more importantly, would keep the pressure on both the governor and the legislature to come to a compromise deal.
So the pressure is still on at this point?
Yes.
Yeah, and what would you say is the next thing we should be looking for with respect to the budget?
We hang out in the corridors because the next thing in the state budget is going to be in private. They're going to be these private negotiations that occur between this governor, the Senate president, Donna Susie, the House Speaker, Steve Shurtleff, and the House and Senate chairs of the Finance Committees, Lou D'Alessandro, Mary Jane Wallner. They're going to be meeting in private and trying to see if they can find some common ground. So we're going to look for that white smoke.
More on the week's news in just a little bit. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Let's check in now. The New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. This week, the state's military veterans lost a doctor with remarkable skill and heart. William Ed Coyce ran the spine clinic at the Manchester VA. 2 years ago, Coyce led a group of whistleblowers whose allegations of substandard care prompted massive reforms in New Hampshire's only VA medical center. After work on Tuesday, Coyce was driving home to Massachusetts when his car went off the road on I-95 in Hampton. Police believe he suffered some kind of medical event while driving. He was pronounced dead at Portsmouth Hospital. He was 62 years old. Recently, I spoke with Stuart Levinson, fellow Manchester VA whistleblower and friend of Dr. Coyce, and I asked him about the way Coyce practiced medicine.
His style was very hands-on and very informal. As a matter of fact, I can tell you story after story with him. He was very astute because he grew up on the streets of Pennsylvania, and he'd seen it all, sort of like myself. I'm from New York City, and he would see patients that no one else could figure out. And he'd ask the patients very blunt questions to startle them, and they wouldn't be able to lie because he caught them so off guard. Like once there was this patient that had this odd symptoms, and Ed says to him, looks him in the eye and very casually says, so how do you cook your rock, in a bottle cap or with a piece of foil? And the patient came clean and said, yes, he was using crack. And Ed sort of solved the whole case.
What do you think Dr. Coyce has achieved by teaming up with folks like you and blowing the whistle on the Manchester VA?
That business as usual cannot continue to happen. You can't look good on paper while veterans are suffering, that these administrators will always be looking over their shoulder that somebody, because it was unheard of. No one had ever done anything like this, going to the Boston Globe spotlight team the way we did. So whatever happens, even if there's some drift back towards complacency at the VA, they know now that because of people like Ed Coyce, that you can't ignore these deserving patients.
You and Dr. Coyce, 2 years ago, when you went to the Boston Globe, talked extensively about the VA's over-reliance, in your view, on metrics, bad metrics. As a result of the work that you and Dr. Coyce did the VA make any changes to the way they use metrics?
I think in the grand scheme they have. They're still using the same system, but they don't rely on it as much. They publish it, but before they worship those metrics. If the metrics were good, nothing else had to be done. But if the metrics now, the way they use them, is that they could have the best four-star or what have you ratings, they'll still look under the carpet and behind the sink, so to speak, to see what the problems are. And that's why I think he had a lasting effect on it.
One of the big changes that came immediately upon the publication of the story in the Boston Globe, where Dr. Coyce and you were featured, is that the Manchester VA got new leadership at the top. How important is leadership and the style of leadership, and is it better now?
Leadership is the number one problem at the VA. Leadership and culture, and I believe the two are intimately related. I used to have a little piece of paper up in my office that used to say something like, culture can eat strategy for breakfast, and leadership can overcome that. And Ed was a natural leader. He was very active in the spinal cord group, in physiatry there. He took a very sleepy department that wasn't doing very much and really got it off the ground. And he made it clear that the upper management in Manchester couldn't be ignoring the problems of the veteran.
Mm-hmm. One of the services that Ed Coyce provided by virtue of being a whistleblower is that for people like me, for journalists, he was someone who you could call for an unvarnished look at the VA. Typically at the VA, you're not allowed, if you're an employee, to speak to the press. You have to go through their official press channels. But Ed Coyce was different because he was a whistleblower. Now that he's gone, I'm wondering if the VA runs the risk of becoming somewhat less transparent. I was wondering what your thoughts would be on that.
Well, the example he set, I think, makes people more apt to become whistleblowers. Because remember, at the congressional field hearing, the VA kept on saying, we love whistleblowers. I mean, obviously, it was disingenuous, but it certainly came through that they expected more of them to be coming along. And that
can I interrupt you for a moment? Why do you think it
sure.
was disingenuous?
Oh, the VA saying they love whistleblowers? I mean, even the congressional delegation, when that was said, rolled their eyes. I mean, they have a long history of not being transparent. And so when people like Ed brought transparency, it was something they had to deal with that they had never dealt with before. These metrics that are useless are actually the opposite of transparency because they're not useful metrics. And people like Ed ensured that at least people knew that transparency is helpful, that it will result in improvement, and that Ed worked there until his death. So they didn't get rid of him. I'm sure that that was considered at different points, but they knew that he was not one to be trifled with.
Dr. Stuart Leberenson, a friend of Dr. Coyce, colleague of Dr. Coyce, and whistleblower at the Manchester VA. Thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for listening, and thank you for noting Dr. Coyce's wonderful life.
And other stories that NHPR has been following this week, Eversource has officially pulled the plug on its Northern Pass transmission line. The utility filed a notice with the Federal Securities and Exchange Commission late yesterday. It notifies shareholders that the company sees no way forward for its signature project, which it spent nearly a decade promoting. Also, two former employees of the Sununu Youth Services Center have been indicted on a combined 82 counts of aggravated sexual assault against a minor who was in custody there during the late 1990s. The state attorney general's office says it is also opening a wider investigation into the treatment of minors at the facility from 1990 to the year 2000. And there are plans for a memorial to honor the seven motorcyclists killed in a crash in Randolph, New Hampshire last month. The American Legion Post 82 in Gorham is working to create a memorial near the crash site. The memorial will be made of granite and have the logo of the Jarheads Motorcycle Club. There will also be benches, a U.S. Marine Corps logo, and a parking area. And one more story to talk about before the end of the program today. The NHPR reported this week that the New Hampshire Department of Transportation is taking steps toward building a commuter rail line through New Hampshire's Capital Corridor. Kevin, this project has been in the works for a long time, or at least discussed for a long time.
It really has, to restore commuter rail business from Boston to Nashua and then on to Concord. There was some important legislation that just passed in the last week that became law, by the way, without Governor Chris Sununu's signature, which allows the state to apply for federal money for what's called the development phase of this project. Excuse me. It also allows the state to claim turnpike toll revenues kind of as a state match for, and the development phase would get you right to the point at where you could then apply for federal funds to actually construct the railroad. That would, so even with this move, and it's important, I mean, Sununu once called this project a boondoggle, then Amazon said commuter rail is critical to where we're going to locate our second place location nationally, so he dropped his opposition. But even with this move, we're 18 months to 2 years away from actually getting to a point of asking the federal government for money to build the project.
And so we're coming up to the end of the program. I just want to ask you all really quickly what you might be following in the news next week. We'll start with you, Dean.
Well, next week, Tuesday night and Wednesday night, we have the next round of Democratic presidential debates. So I'll be watching those closely. The first night, the interest there is Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren on the same stage together, Pete Buttigieg as well, and the rest of the group there tend to be more kind of centrist to moderate Democrats. So it will be interesting to see if they carry the banner for progressives in the party. And then the second night, it's essentially a rematch of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. So that's what I'll be focused on for most of next week.
Dan Tuohy.
Yeah, Elizabeth Warren's in town this weekend. We'll be covering her campaign visits and just seeing where these candidates go next week. They're in Detroit for
They'll
the second
prepping,
debate.
Yeah.
They're trying to make inroads here.
Kevin, what are you going to be looking at next
week? Voting rights. One thing we didn't talk about, a judge earlier this week actually moved the trial until December of a lawsuit that challenges restrictions on voter registration that Republicans and Governor Chris Sununu supported. There was some legislation that would actually undo some of those changes. They're now on that legislation passed by the legislature, the Democratic legislature, is on the desk of Governor Sununu. He has until Monday to decide what to do with it. We think the veto tracker is going to be busy early next week.
All right. Busy week coming up. Thank you, everybody, for being here today. Kevin Landrigan, newly appointed State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and Dan Tuohy, NHPR digital engagement producer. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
And that's it for today. But remember, the conversation continues online on Facebook and at NHPR.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.